Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. This is Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to be joined by David Chipman. David is a guy who knows a thing or two about guns. He used to be a member of the ATF's Rapid Response Team. I'm not sure what they call them. Basically, their SWAT team. And he's going to talk to us about Donald Trump's harebrained scheme to arm teachers and make them into little John McClanes. Then we're going to be joined by Topher Spiro from the Center for American Progress. He's a senior fellow for health policy. He's going to talk about CAP's new Medicare Extra for All plan, something that is, I think, a good approach, a smart approach. And then finally, we'll be joined by Frank Clement. Frank is the executive director for Americans for Tax Fairness, and he's going to talk to us about this this corporate propaganda campaign to improve the popularity of the GOP tax bill. By the way, I have a piece up at thenation.com quoting Frank and others, including Dean Baker, who's been on the show before, and it's titled, "A Wave of Corporate Propaganda is Boosting Trump's Tax Cuts." We have a really full show this week. There's lots to cover. So I'm going to skip the little introduction. And, oh, by the way, in lieu of the introduction, little tidbits that I pick up from the week, I'm doing this new feature. I haven't mentioned it yet on the show yet for Raw Story. It's called What Fresh Hell. And it's a weekly roundup of things that I find were undercovered or at least didn't get the attention that they deserve because we're always looking at whatever shiny object Donald Trump is throwing out there. Check it out. It's at the Raw Story. It's called What Fresh Hell. It goes up every Saturday. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with David Chipman.
Once upon a time at the foot of a great mountain, there was a town where the people known as Happy Folk lived. Their very existence a mystery to the rest of the world, obscured as it was by great clouds. Here they played out their peaceful lives, innocent of the litany of excess and violence that was growing in the world below. To live in harmony with the spirit of the mountain called Monkey was enough. Then one day, strange folk arrived in the town. They came in camouflage, hidden behind dark glasses, but no one noticed them. They only saw shadows. You see, without the truth of the eyes, the happy folk were blind.
Falling out of aeroplanes and hiding out in holes, waiting for the sunset to come, people going home. Jump out from behind them and shoot them in the head. Now everybody dancing, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead.
In time, strange folk found their way into the higher reaches of the mountain, and it was there that they found the caves of unimaginable sincerity and beauty. By chance, they stumbled upon the place where all good souls come to rest. The strange folk, they coveted the jewels in these caves above all things, and soon they began to mine the mountain, its rich seam fueling the chaos of their own world. Meanwhile, down in the town, the happy folks slept restlessly, their dreams invaded by shadowy figures digging away at their souls. Every day, people would wake and stare at the mountain. Why was it bringing darkness into their lives? And as the strange folk mined deeper and deeper into the mountain, holes began to appear, bringing with them a cold and bitter wind that chilled the very soul of the monkey. For the first time, the happy folk felt fearful, for they knew that soon the monkey would stir from its deep sleep. Then there came a sound, distant first, that grew into gastrophony, so immense that it could be heard far away in space. There were no screams. There was no time. The mountain called Monkey had spoken. There was only fire. And then
nothing.
Oh, a little town in the USA, the time has come to see. There's nothing you believe you want. But where were you when it all came down on me? Did you call me home?
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. So, you know, one of the things, the kind of rhetorical strategies of the gun debate, of the pro-gun side, is to dismiss the opinions of people who aren't experts. And if you ever get into like a debate on Twitter or social media, make sure that you don't refer to a clip as a magazine, because that just makes them, they just say, well, if you don't know that it's a magazine. Like, if you watch police movies and they go, oh, I'm down to my last clip, that's wrong. It's not a clip. It's a magazine. You got to know that. If you don't, you have no right to an opinion. And, you know, never mind that you're seeing children cut down in schools. You still have no right to an opinion. So I figured I'm going to get an expert. My next guest is David Chipman. David is a senior policy advisor for the Giffords Courage Campaign, Gabby Giffords, former Representative Gabby Giffords' organization, and he was a former ATF agent, so he knows a thing or two about firearms. David Chipman, welcome to the show.
Well, Joshua, thanks so much, and I'm excited that you've learned from our previous conversation, because you did not use the C word, which is a true trap, and thank you for knowing what a magazine is.
it's a remarkably dishonest debate in many ways, and I think the one thing that people need to understand is that we're effectively being held hostage to the idea that what happens in the movies is very much like reality. So the good guys, in addition to the fact that their guns never run out of bullets unless it's important for the plot, they never miss their targets. Bullets don't hit them. It's all very clean and antiseptic, and they take out the bad guy. And it doesn't really work that way in the real world. David, let me ask you this. If you're someone who doesn't follow this closely, and you hear Donald Trump saying, let's arm school teachers, what is the problem with that? You think, well, look, we have this problem with schools. We're not going to post policemen in every classroom. Why not train them? Why not send them to the range, make sure that they're proficient with their weapons, and hope that they can stop the next massacre? What is the problem with that?
Yeah, so let me break it down a couple of ways. I guess the first thing I would want to explore is what the president really said is the presence of guns in the hands of teachers would serve as a deterrent. And deterrence is something I believe in policing. I think in certain respects, it does work. The problem is that at least with the school shooter we were dealing with here and other mass shooters, it was described by the president that he also thought that this person suffered from severe mental illness. And as we know, most mass shooters, it's basically a suicide attack. So that's when deterrence falls apart. If you're willing to die, you know, it's tough to imagine that a deterrence would work. So let's explore, though, like let's say that it isn't a deterrent, but perhaps the outcome could be better. So you're right. I was a trained SWAT team member for ATF. I, in fact, was issued a semi-automatic AR-15 during my duties. So I know what that gun can do. And I know the type of training that I had just to be proficient at shooting and to also be proficient at, when the chips were down, actually killing another human being. And I'll get back to that. But I also have some expertise in teaching because my father is a mathematics professor. Now, my dad and I are very different people. For instance, for his birthday, I bought him a gift. And that gift was this device that caught bugs on the wall of his house so that he could let them go outside of his house. So this is a person who's wired just like not wanting to kill anything. And I think that although that's funny, it's interesting how people assume that everyone is capable of killing another human being. And the research just shows that's not true. There's this famous book written called On Killing by David Grossman, who studied how training in the military has evolved over the years, because they used to qualify shooting at round targets. And what they found in like World War II and earlier battles, that many people did not fire their guns. And even when they fired their guns, they would purposely fire over the enemy. And so they had to train people to actually shoot at targets that looked more like humans. And that's why police qualify today on targets that aren't round, but are shaped like humans. And so I think that unless you are trained, and you're trained over and over again, and you practice like you play, which means you're trained in simulated life or death environments, the likelihood of you even firing your gun, and then the fact that that gun would actually hit someone who's a moving target surrounded by other moving targets, is just any trained operator knows the fallacy in that. That's highly unlikely that it would turn out well. Now, there's a limited case. Like, you know, the pro-gun people say this. Well, what happens if you're lined up against a wall and people are being slowly executed one at a time? Would you want a gun? Okay, well, yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah, of course, I would. But, you know, that's not really the scenario we're talking about.
I want to really stick on this. You referenced that we had spoken before. I interviewed David for a piece that I wrote a couple of years ago. It's at thenation.com. It's called Tactical Experts Destroy the NRA's Heroic Gunslinger Fantasies. There is a natural human stress reaction that law enforcement and the military, you trained on this when you were with the ATF's version of the SWAT team, that the military and law enforcement train extensively to overcome a natural reaction to moments of extremely high stress. You have adrenaline coursing through your body, and it makes it very difficult to respond in a effective, smart manner. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, sure. When you're in a life or death encounter, you know, your blood goes to your major organs, and there's a lot of tunnel vision that you get. And when you train repeatedly under similar conditions, I think 30, 40 years ago, they would put you under stress by actually physically hurting you. I think they'd, you know, rough you up a bit. I mean, the stress I went through is they exhaust you, because being very tired is similar to stress. So they wouldn't let you sleep for like 12 hours, or they'd wake you up in the middle of the night and force you to do something, you know, high risk like this. We also trained where we were fighting, simulated situations where we were firing live ammo around each other. And I can tell you that there's a difference in how you respond to a situation where you know what you're firing is paintball and you know what you're firing are real bullets. I mean, it just changes everything. And so those are some of the things. I think, too, you have to understand the element of fear. And this has more to do with not people who are forced to do something because they're caught in the middle, like they're about to get shot. But we saw that, you know, one of the officers there, there's been some criticism that he didn't act as certain people thought he should. I can just tell you that the fear involved in doing these operations is something that every individual deals with on their own terms. I'd say law enforcement doesn't really provide much law enforcement support to how to deal with these things beyond training. And cops are really good at drinking together and telling stories, but they never really talk about what's really going on. For me personally, part of my story is to get through these operations. I had this sort of, and I've never talked about this before, but sir, you asked the question, but you know, this sort of this way in which I would actually pretend that I was already dead. And in that way, I had the courage to do what I needed to do to safely protect my team and do the operation. Now, how many other people do that? I don't know. I can just share my own experience, but I can just tell you that the movies in real life is so absolutely different that it concerns me that we have a president talking about things that are way beyond his scope of qualifications.
Yes, and remember, he got multiple deferments to from Vietnam. Not that I would slight anybody from doing that, but the idea that he knows what he's talking about on the subject is pretty ludicrous. What is tunnel vision? What is that? What is that? What's the practical effect of coming down with tunnel vision? By the way, let me just point out that I spoke to some other experts for that same piece, and the majority of people, when they experience extreme stress for the first time, even when they have that training, is that they freeze up.
Yeah, it can happen. That's why, and I answer both of your questions, but I know early in my career, we used to shoot at stationary targets, and there would be scores recorded. And then, you know, people rightfully said, well, like how many times do you, you know, shoot at people who are standing still? And then we started moving to shooting in ranges that were dark, because most shootings happen at night, and we started shooting on the move, where we'd actually have to be running and shooting, or the target would be moving. And then even more advanced training, and it sounds funny, but we would actually use paintball, because, you know, when you're getting shot at, and they used to, in Michigan, the big thing is that our trainers would freeze the paintballs, which would mean when they hit your skin, they would split your skin. And I can just tell you, when you're seeking cover from which to fire from, you don't want to be hit by these things, but you need to simulate the real conditions. And so that's another thing we're talking about. I mean, most people practice, they're not having, you know, rounds of ammunition zinging past their head. The issue of tunnel vision is what your body does because of this increased blood flow. You lose your peripheral vision, and you only see that which you're focusing on. And the problem becomes you become hyper focused on that one target, and you don't see like innocent victims nearby, or you don't see other offenders, because sometimes people act alone, or you don't see your partners who might be coming there. And so it's a very dangerous thing that through breathing and just practice, you need to overcome, because it can be, you know, it can put you in a situation where you not only don't shoot your correct target, but you hit unintended people.
Now, we should acknowledge that, as you did, obviously there are occasional situations where it is proper, if you are armed, to intervene. But for the most part, law enforcement counsels people not to intervene in an active shooting situation unless you're immediately in front of the shooter and have, you know, a very clear-cut shot, and then you should put your weapon down immediately. Why is that?
Well, I mean, for a host of reasons, and that's a good point. Actually, law enforcement receives training discouraging them, at least, you know, initially, unless it's, you know, clear and imminent danger, not to act with your gun off duty in a situation, that rather be a good witness, because there's so many incidents where off-duty officers are trying to render aid or defuse a situation, they're actually killed by law enforcement. In fact, John Capano, who was the last ATF agent killed in the line of duty, had that happen to him. It was New Year's Eve. He was going to a pharmacy to pick up prescription for his father. He walked into the middle of a prescription robbery. He engaged this robber, got into a fight with them, had his weapon drawn, and another off-duty cop shot and killed him.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, these have real consequences. And it's one of those things that, especially in public safety, some aspects of it are like being a doctor. You never want to do harm. You don't want to be trying to do good and escalate or make a situation worse. And it seems to me that in teachers, this idea of putting a gun in their hands is really almost giving up in this issue. The time that we needed to focus on the shooter in Florida was every moment prior to him exiting his Uber with a military-style assault rifle. And what I mean by that is all of the warning signs, how we regulate guns in America, his mental health condition, and what do we do to help them. Those were all of the opportunities to be heroes and save the day. Not after he began shooting, because we know once the shots are fired, things move so quickly that even trained people cannot react quick enough to actually stop the shooting from occurring. And how do we know that? Just look at the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan, surrounded by trained Secret Service officers, professionals from the DC Police Department. The damage was already done before they could even draw their weapons. In Texas, where we had that massacre at the church, it really wasn't until that person exited the church that a trained civilian took action, but the killing had already occurred. Like, I want to live in a world where we stop the murder, the homicides, this carnage before it ever happens in the first place. Nevada in Las Vegas is another example. I saw reports that there were 200 off-duty police officers from California attending the concert. We know that there were officers responding into the hotel and armed security in the hotel. That's the biggest mass shooting in history. So I don't think it's an absence of guns that are ever going to make our country safer. It's more reasonable regulations that help us keep guns from getting out of the hands of these people who want to do us harm.
Let's turn to that briefly. We only have a few more minutes, but and I don't want to get too wonky in the weeds, but just generally speaking, one thing that I find about this debate is that it seems to me that we need a comprehensive approach. And I think that the discussion often gets derailed. When you mention mental health, for example, people think that that means that you're trying to avoid the issue of, say, banning assault weapons or other forms of gun control. We don't really approach it in this comprehensive way that we do with other public health issues. You know, when they introduced seatbelts, they didn't stop making cars safer. It decreased the fatalities of accidents dramatically, but they kept working to make vehicles safer and safer. And now your chances of surviving a vehicular crash are a fraction of what they once were. What are some of the measures that the Giffords Courage campaign are advocating right now?
Well, I love your conversation about this culture of safety. I grew up just north of Detroit, so I'm very aware of the period by which, as a child, I grew up riding in a car without seatbelts, with both my parents smoking Pall Malls, and I think I was sitting over the gas tank, to where we are today, right, where we have mandatory seatbelt laws, we have airbags, and we have other sensors that help us drive safe, and it's actually become cool to buy a safe car. So cars are marketed as being the safest, and that has evolved over several decades. And so I do believe at Giffords, you know, I'm a concealed carry owner. Mark Kelly is a combat war veteran. Even Gabby has a naval warship filled with guns named after. We are not anti-gun. What we are is we recognize all too well how lethal guns can be in the wrong hands and how accidental shootings and other things can, you know, impact this country and families in a bad way. So we do have programs where we want there to be more focus on what are smart technologies, what are different technologies that can make guns safer, visible signs that a gun would show that it's loaded, from ways to lock up your gun easily, to just securing guns in your car. One of the biggest things that is happening to law enforcement today is as more people are carrying guns outside their home, they're leaving them unsecured in cars, and then they're easily stolen, and then those guns are used in crime. My boss in Detroit retired from ATF, and within 2 years, he was walking his dog outside in Northern Virginia, and he was murdered with a gun by someone who had stolen it from a car two blocks away. So that these are real things that happen to real people. And I think that people will do the right thing if it becomes the cultural norm, sort of like don't drive drunk, you know, that kind of thing. You lock up your car. And when it's sort of cool and easy, you know, so if I have a device that I know I can put my gun, and if I really need it, I just put my fingerprint on it and I can get the gun every time, that's sort of cool. And I think more people will do it. Unfortunately, the gun lobby sees safety as a potential mandate, and they just oppose any regulation or mandate whatsoever as a matter of principle. And so that's what we're up against. But I think the more we get cops like me and veterans and other gun owners saying, hey, look, I like my rights to have a gun, but I know how dangerous it is, and I want to make it safe, I think we're getting progress.
I think another piece of this that's important is that the gun lobby says that they are okay, you know, trying to, with efforts to keep guns out of the wrong hands. And that's, they pay lip service to that. They oppose every single measure to do so. And I think that an important component of this is not only closing the so-called gun show loophole, which is not necessarily just gun shows, it allows individuals to transfer weapons between them without a background check, but also these red flag laws that say, look, we're going to empower law enforcement that when somebody is identified as a threat, at least on a temporary basis, we can go in and take their guns. And there's a number of things that just seem like common sense. For example, there's a number of disqualifying mental illnesses that will disqualify you from purchasing a handgun, purchasing a firearm. But when you show up at an emergency room having a mental health crisis and you're given a 72-hour emergency hold, and a doctor, a psychiatrist, says you are a threat to yourself and others, there is no way in most states for law enforcement to intervene in that and make sure that you don't have guns. Things like that need to be part of the bigger picture. And that's why, again, I say we need a comprehensive approach. It's not either or, it's yes and. We need to deal with the culture. I believe that we should ban military style weapons with high capacity magazines that result in greater body counts when other systems fail and these shootings do go down. I think we need to look at it from all of these different angles at the same time. David Chipman, I really thank you for taking the time to speak with me, especially on short notice. I really appreciate your expertise and wisdom on this topic.
It's always a pleasure.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
My boy is mad high. One touch, I'm shell-shined. Makes my hot box try non-stop. Could have been a one-night stand, old man. Could have been a passing thing. Just a little boom, boom.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. Now, I'm going to be a broken record here because regular listeners know that I have this thing about healthcare. I'm very excited about Medicare for All. It really fires people up, and it's good politics because Medicare is something, it's not foreign, it's familiar, it's tested, it's true, tried and true. You know, maybe your grandmother is on it, maybe your mother is on it. It is something that doesn't scare people away. But I also think, and we've talked about this on the show a number of times, that the animating principle that you need to understand with American healthcare and these debates that we've been having is the idea of loss aversion. Loss aversion is this principle, it's really well understood, that people care more about something that they might lose than they do about something that they might gain. In other words, if you say, I'm going to take your health care, your current health care away, even if you promise something better, it animates people. And we've seen this again and again. We saw this with Obamacare. It was unpopular, right? But then Republicans started to take it away. Before that, when Obamacare was passed, remember, it extended health care to about 20 million people. About 5 million people, one quarter of that number, lost these substandard McPlans, really crappy insurance plans, didn't give them the coverage they needed. And that became a rallying cry for the right. Remember, Obama promised you could keep your health care, but you lost your health care. So this is not the only problem I find with the Medicare for All proposals that are on the table from Bernie Sanders and John Conyers in the House. But that's the really big one, because I think that when you add a trillion-dollar scaremongering campaign from the right, from the healthcare industry, about how you're going to lose your healthcare and it's going to be replaced with socialized medicine, I believe that this is going to be unpopular with the public. My next guest is has proposed a hybrid kind of a thing. So it is a roadmap to universal healthcare, universal coverage for every American. It acknowledges that healthcare is a right. But what it does is it leaves the 55, 60% or so of the public who get health insurance through their employers. It doesn't force them to give up something that they don't want to give up. Anyway, so Topher Spiro is the Vice President for Health Policy at Center for American Progress. Topher, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Topher has, he's obviously worked with a team at the Center for American Progress, and they have this new proposal. It's called Medicare Extra for All. You can find that at AmericanProgress.org. Topher, can you give me the highlights of this proposal?
Yeah, and I just want to say off the bat, like when you say hybrid, that makes it sound complicated and wonky. So let me boil it down. It's really a Medicare for All plan, and it's Medicare for All in the sense that if you want Medicare, you can have it. And if you currently have employer coverage, we preserve employer coverage for the millions who want to keep that as an option. But that's basically it in a nutshell. And Medicaid would be strengthened and would be integrated into the new program so that there would be a national standard so that, you know, states that are run by Republicans can't continue to try to gut Medicaid. And people, when they change incomes, would have continuity of care. They'd stay in the same program. We strengthen the Medicaid program for people with disabilities. That's basically it. It's a little different from Medicare in the sense that Medicare has many shortcomings. So we actually create a new plan that is basically the Medicare plan plus additional benefits, including dental care, an out-of-pocket limit, a limit on out-of-pocket costs, eyeglasses, hearing aids, an integrated drug benefit. These are the ways in which current Medicare program actually isn't so good. So we create a new plan. It's called Medicare Extra, and that's the reason why the extra is there. Some people have asked me why it's called Medicare Extra. Current Medicare beneficiaries would have the option to move over to the new Medicare Extra. Presumably many of them would, because it's a better plan. But there, you were speaking of the loss aversion. There may be some who through inertia or just are worried about the change who want to stay in their current Medicare program. So that's the basic structure.
Now, you say that people could stick with their employer sponsored insurance, but employers would also have the option to buy into this program, right?
That's right. And that's a really good option for small employers currently. If they want to, eventually that would be extended to large employers. And I imagine that many more would do so over time as they become more comfortable with the new system, as it becomes clear that the new system's working well and their employees start to demand it. So employers would offer it just like they'd offer an Aetna plan or a Blue Cross plan. They'd offer it as their employer-sponsored plan, and they would make premium contributions just as they make towards your Aetna plan currently. And it would be a form of employer-sponsored insurance. Alternatively, if an employer continues to offer your current Aetna plan, for example, and it has a high deductible that a lower income employee can't afford, then employees who don't want to stay in their employer coverage have the option to enroll in Medicare Extra instead. So we strike this balance in the plan where we recognize that the majority of employees are quite satisfied with their employer coverage on the one hand. But on the other hand, there are employees for whom employer coverage does not work. It's becoming increasingly affordable with deductibles rising faster than wages over time. And so we allow them the choice to switch over to Medicare Extra.
Now, eventually you end up with a very large insurance pool, right? What are some of the advantages of having a large insurance pool in terms of containing healthcare costs?
Yeah, and I should say the insurance pool for Medicare Extra would be guaranteed to get increasingly larger over time because it would automatically enroll newborns and automatically enroll anyone who's turning age 65. So people who change 65 after the law is enacted, they wouldn't go into the current Medicare program. They would go into Medicare Extra instead. So it would grow over time. And as I was saying before, employers would probably increasingly opt into it. And the advantage of that is a bigger risk pool that you've got more healthy people in balancing against the unhealthy people, which keeps the average cost of the program down, and administrative costs, economies of scale. Medicare Extra would have very low administrative costs, just like the current Medicare program has very low administrative costs, has about 2% of program spending are administrative costs under the current Medicare program, compared to upwards of 15 or 20% of spending for private insurance. So Medicare Extra would leverage its economies of scale to have very low administrative costs, and that savings would help finance the program.
It also creates a kind of virtuous cycle where as costs grow lower, that's a good incentive for employers to be like, well, maybe I'll ditch Aetna. And eventually that pool becomes larger. We had Harold Pollack on the show talking about the ways that with a larger insurance pool, some of the ways that you can tinker with kind of innovative programs in terms of changing the incentive structure, et cetera, et cetera. There's other advantages in terms of innovation that you can get when you have this larger insurance pool. And I love the idea of enrolling newborns. So how long does that auto enrollment last? How does that work?
Well, it's just to make sure that everyone is getting into the system. Now, we probably would allow, let's say the newborn's parents are on employer-based coverage. You know, it probably wouldn't make sense to to keep the newborn or to force the newborn to stay in Medicare Extra with the parents on different insurance. So I think we'd have to have an opt out where the parents could the newborn could join the parents' policy. But otherwise, newborns would be automatically enrolled going forward. And the other way in which the program makes sure that everyone's insured is that, you know, anyone who doesn't have job-based coverage, premiums would be paid through the tax system. So anyone who shows up at a provider, at a hospital, would be automatically eligible for the program. Eligibility would be automatic because premiums will have already been paid. So in that way, it's a true universal system. This is the key distinguishing characteristic of universal systems in other developed countries. It's the way they achieve universal coverage, payment of premiums through the tax system.
And I really want to just, I want to harp on this for a second. I know it seems wonky and small, but, you know, we had Jacob Hacker talking about the Hacker plan and maybe 2 months ago, and he's the Hacker plan then through the legislative sausage making is kind of what Obamacare was based on. And he was talking about this crucial difference that you're referring to. In other countries, we give people health care and then we figure out how to pay for it. And we do it through a mix of statutory insurance and taxes and employer contributions, and varies a lot by country to country. But the main thing is that we automatically give them coverage and then work backwards.
Right.
Whereas the Obamacare, although it was a good step forward, obviously, it's still kludgy. It still requires that you pursue coverage, et cetera, et cetera. And people fall through the cracks because
that's
of
right. Yeah. I mean, in the system like we have now, the government has to spend money on outreach. The insurance companies have to spend money on marketing to go out and try and find people. Under this new kind of system that we're proposing, there would be no need to go find people. They would be automatically eligible.
This is a really important difference, and that would be a game changer. Let me ask you a little bit about the politics of this. Do you think that this would be something that would be that's going to be widely embraced by Democrats moving forward? I know that you're a wonk and I shouldn't ask you too much about politics, but I mean, what is the political rationale behind coming up with a proposal that is both very bold and also rejects some of the problems that I was talking about with the Sanders/Conyers approach?
Well, I mean, I think that after repeal was defeated last year, that a lot of people have started thinking about, okay, what's the path forward? And it's going to be a debate that we're going to be having over the coming years. And so we just thought we had some interesting ideas to contribute to that debate. And I think it's part of a larger vision of Medicare for All that Senator Sanders has been a champion of. And it's a question of, okay, how do you fulfill that vision? And so I'd like to emphasize the points of commonality, which are to that vision, which are guaranteeing universal coverage, for one. Secondly, eliminating underinsurance, so making sure that out-of-pocket costs aren't too high to a point where people can't afford health care. Third, using the leverage of the system to restrain prices charged by providers, which is a key feature of other developed countries, and it's a major feature if we want to have universal coverage to finance it. Otherwise, the math just doesn't add up. And lastly, giving everyone the right to enroll in the same plan. So I like to emphasize those commonalities and the overarching vision. And you know, there's the key difference is, you know, should we preserve employer coverage? And you know, where you land on that depends on how much you think it's politically feasible to eliminate it. And it's not just that, though. It's also there's a bit of a policy issue, which is, you know, there is this satisfaction with employer coverage. So I think that's how I look at it.
Now, the thing about costs is important to understand. I mean, I know that you want to stress the commonality, but I think it's important to talk about the differences a little bit. One of the things that the Conyers plan and the Sanders plan does is that they promise that there is no cost whatsoever for anybody in terms of out-of-pocket costs. This is something that no other country has, right? And that requires raising taxes not only to offset existing spending in the healthcare sector, but also adding picking up a whole other, I think it was, I don't want to speak the number out from memory, but it was something like an extra $1 trillion or something like that. It was a huge amount of money to cover this. And what this plan does is it says, look, if you're under 150% of the federal poverty line, which was the original cutoff for the Medicaid expansion in the House version of Obamacare, you pay nothing. There's no deductibles, there's no co-payments, nothing like that. And then if you make more than that, it varies between what? It covers between 80 and 100%, right?
Right.
And that means that you're talking about, you know, a more realistic thing. The thing that the single payer, the Sanders, Conyers advocates always say is that, you know, it's dishonest to say that we can't afford their proposals. And that's true if you look at things in the abstract, right? I mean, a dollar that your employer is spending and that you're paying a piece of that goes to Aetna is actually worth the same as a dollar that you might pay in taxes to replace it. But politically, those things are not equal. And this is something that I think that progressives who care about universal healthcare coverage, who want to get to Medicare for all, Medicare available for all, have to grapple with. It's the politics. If you are talking about raising taxes by trillions of dollars, that is a much more difficult political lift than a more modest figure. I just think that these are, a lot of this is portrayed, this debate right now is portrayed as like progressives versus the establishment or centrists. And I think that that's missing the diversity in approaches that other countries take. I guess that's my point. You know, there's this idea that there are these pristine single-payer systems where everybody just gets health care and it's paid for entirely through general funds, through taxes. And that system doesn't exist anywhere. I mean, maybe it exists in North Korea. I don't know. But it doesn't exist in these, you know, European social democracies that a lot of us as progressives think have developed a better model than what we have right now. Topher, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to explain this plan. And I hope people do give it a shot, give it a fair reading. It's up at AmericanProgress.org. It's called Medicare Extra for All, a plan to guarantee universal health coverage in the United States. You can also look at my name in The Nation. I've proposed a pretty similar proposal and explained my rationale for that. Topher Spiro, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. When you're passing on your way, I say, hello, little girl. When I see you passing by, I cry.
try to catch your eye, I cry. Mm-hmm. Hello, little girl. Hello. I send you flowers, but you don't care. You never seem to see me standing there. Come a day when you say, you're my little girl. Hello. It's not the first time that it's happened to me. It's been a long, lonely time. And it's so funny to see that I'm about to lose my mind, my mind. So I hope there'll come a day when you say, you're my little girl. You're my little girl. You're my little girl. Oh yeah. You're my little girl.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm very pleased to welcome Frank Clementi back. Frank is the executive director for Americans for Tax Fairness. They do really good work. They have a new report out. It's about this really massive corporate propaganda campaign to kind of make it seem like there's a lot of trickle down going on from the disastrous tax cuts that Donald Trump signed into law and has touted. And Frank and his crew have a report. It's called Major Corporations Getting Huge Trump Tax Cuts, Not Very Generous to Workers. You can find it at AmericansForTaxFairness.org. Frank, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua, for having me.
Now we see this like real outpouring of, again, I use this term corporate propaganda. It seems to me that that's what's going on here. Tell me some of the highlights of this report.
Sure. Also, obviously, nothing brings Republicans together more than big tax cuts for corporations. This was an agenda for the last couple of decades that they've had. So the president delivered big time for them, and they're extremely happy about it. The most important, this is an ongoing project that we are monitoring. To put into perspective what these announcements are like that are being made by Apple and Exxon and Pfizer and other large corporations. The way to think about it is we're looking at the Fortune 500 companies. Those are the biggest companies in America. And we're going to keep track of how many of them are offering bonuses, how many of them are offering wage increases, how many of them are making new investments in the economy, and how much are they getting in tax breaks. That's the comparison we're trying to do. This is the first look at it, and what we found is that of the 500 corporations, only one out of 10 was providing any kind of economic benefit to its workers. So these are corporations that are getting, in many cases, more than $1 billion a year each in tax breaks, and they're distributing a very small amount of money to their workers in one-time benefits.
And just to put this all in context, there were four oil companies got $11 billion from the tax bill in the fourth quarter of 2017. $11 billion. Why do you think, I know that you can't speculate, but put yourself in the head of someone working in, I don't know, corporate communications or I guess higher up in Pfizer or something like that. Is this just an effort to validate the belief that tax cuts, the conservative belief, the talking points that tax cuts translate into wage increases? Or is there something else going on? Are they trying to stay on Trump's good side or get on Trump's good side? I mean, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I mean, a good public relations executive is going to understand that if word gets out that our tax rate is going to go from 30% down to 15% or 9%, AbbVie, a major drug maker, their tax rate is only going to be 9%. ExxonMobil is probably going to save $1 billion or more in taxes next year alone. So they came out with a statement this week that, they're going to make $50 billion in new investments in America. Now, we took a look at that. We went back and looked at, well, what did they do over the last 10 year, over the last 5 years? And it turns out that over the last 5 years, they actually made $53 billion in investments in America, whereas earlier this week they said they're going to make $50 billion over the next 5 years in new investments because of the tax law. So they're taking what they were already going to do, and they're just simply spinning out a yarn that, oh, this new investment, which probably is going to create a whole bunch of jobs, is due to the tax break. And it's not. It's due to the business environment. And as many of us are aware, because we're now paying more at the pump, gas prices have come back up. Price of oil is going up quite a bit. And so all of a sudden, there's a lot more business there for ExxonMobil. And so, of course, it's going to jack up its investment because it now becomes a lot of wells that they had abandoned now become more profitable again. Everything that the business community does for the next period of time that it is its normal course of procedure is going to be spun as due to the tax breaks because they know how opposed to giving tax breaks to corporations the American public is. When they designed this whole campaign to get the law passed, it was always the driving force was to give corporations tax breaks. And they had to add to it giving tax breaks to middle-income people in order for it to be acceptable, in order for the public relations to not be too bad on it, for the public to not be too much up in arms against it. So they're just continuing this effort, and they've doubled down on it to try and convince the public that this is a good thing. They're reading the same polls that we're reading. Two-thirds of the public opposes this tax bill. They need to change that dynamic.
And there's a flip side to all of this, right? Because there have been a number of layoffs announced since all of this started, and that's probably not being featured as prominently as these bonuses are in the reporting.
Yeah, well, one thing Walmart, for instance, yes, it takes you 20 years to get the $1,000. If you have been there 2 years, you get $200. So, but they're promoting this at the top line number and getting a credit for that. I think one thing I want to just say about the bonuses, people really need to understand that is a one-time deal. It's not built into your wages permanently so that becomes your new base salary or your new base wage the next year. Whereas the corporate tax breaks, they're going to get those forever. You are only going to get this one-time bonus pay bump, and it's just really important to distinguish between one-time and truly increasing your wages permanently. On the jobs front, we've tracked now. There's eight companies since this bill has passed, the law became enacted. Eight companies have laid off 27,000 workers. Those are permanent layoffs. Including Walmart. Ironically, at the same time, Walmart was announcing that it was going to give a $1,000 bonus if you worked there 20 years. It was also saying we're going to close 63 Sam's Club stores across the country, and it's going to cost about 10,000 jobs. So, you give on one hand, you take away a lot worse on the other hand.
Frank, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua. Always a pleasure.
I also want to thank David Chipman and Topher Spiro. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on Podbean or iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever else you can find it. I'd also like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo, that's Digby's place, Crooks and Liars, and The Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. Finally, I'd like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.